I met Lewis Ferrier 9 years ago. He was the last of the commercial cooter boat fishermen operating out of Queenscliff, fishing town and seaside resort that's about 100 k's southwest of Melbourne near the Port Phillip Heads. Lou Ferrier is now 89 years old. On December the 1st, 1924, he was born on the beach at Queenscliff. And what he doesn't know about the sea, this is his story.
My first breath was sea air, and I think I've got more than a share of salt water mixed with my blood. If all goes well, with fire as many fine days as possible and good health thrown in, I go out and fish as often as I can. It beats working, because it's a way of life. And I just do what I'm able to do, and I enjoy every moment, and I count every fish I catch, every fish. Even kissed them long before Rex Hunt even thought of the idea. It was a common practice among every young fisherman going back to the early 1870s. The first fish they caught, they kissed it. That's how exciting and thrilling fishing is. It's a way of life. And if my strength and my body allows me, I'll still try and fish as long as I can. My mother was born here at Queenscliff, 1880, and her name was Frances Elizabeth Aiken. And at 18, she met an itinerant fisherman from Warrnambool by the name of William John Ferrier. And the circumstances were such that my father left Warrnambool because of the lean period of time of fishing, and he came to Queenscliff. And he was here about 10 months, and he met Mum, and he would go up and meet Mum, particularly of a Sunday night, after the 7 o'clock evening service at the Presbyterian Church. And lo and behold, but Mum with other girlfriends and that, they'd all have a chuckle when standing outside the church with a red cravat on or red scarf and a white fisherman's pullover was this handsome man, Sammy Ferrier. And of course, time went on and Mum was chided from her elder sisters, but they got married in 1900. I doubt that there could be a more passionate person born in Queenscliff other than myself. Now, my mother was pregnant, and on the 1st of December 1924, a record catch of salmon was caught between the piers at Queenscliff. There was only one pier now left standing, and it's a great tourist attraction. And it was in that vicinity when the crowds of tourists and other folk were down on the beachfront. And it was quite an event in the small town of fishermen that wives and sweethearts and that would go and lend a hand. And this is something that Mum couldn't see any reason why she should be left out of it. So she was pulling on the rope with 40 or 50 other people, and on the other side of the net where another rope was being hauled by a group of people, Dad noticed Mum. And he just let the line go and walked across and spoke to Mum, as she quoted to me, and said, "Come on, Frances, in your condition you shouldn't be here." And nothing else was said. And Mum just let go of the rope, and someone else eagerly took over. And she only walked not 20 paces from the water's edge, and I came away. And she knelt down on the sand and lifted my head and put it on her left thigh. And Mum was just sitting there with me on the in the squatting, and she said, "Young girl, do you know where the midwife lives?" And she said, "Yes, Mrs. Ferrier." And Mum said, "Well, will you go and tell her that Frances has had her baby on the beach near the pier?" Well, this Thelma Trinick, a young fisherman's descendant, 17 and a half years of age, And she went up and got Lizzie Fox, and Lizzie helped Mum up on her feet and with me and put me straight to where a baby should go at first off. And I must have been suckling on Mum's breast all the way home, which is only about 300 yards from the pier. And that's how I came into the world. And I was the ninth of the 10 sons that Mum reared. Only three sisters I can remember, but Mum reared 18 of her children. Jeffrey Lewis, Manson, Nelson, Colin, Stevie, Frankie, Valley, Willie, Jackie, Alice, Olive, Maine, Jean, Joan, Patricia, Yvonne. You know, to rear 18 of their children, it says a lot for the women of those days, doesn't it? And they weren't offered the money for it by being bribed by the governments of the day today. Mum would be a millionaire if she'd have kept going.
The locals call Lewis Ferrier the barefoot fisherman, and he's never seen any reason to wear shoes.
I got a photograph of me when I was 9, and I was in lace-up boots, and I was delivering newspapers. And then I come home and I said to Mum, what are these for? And she says, oh, you've got to wear them. I said, but I don't like them. And me, my brother Jeffrey, my brother Mansley, my brother Nelson, my sister Olive, I can remember those five going to school at the same time. And we were barefooted. And I can remember the headmaster having nothing against them coming in bare feet. And I can remember the wonderful feeling of stepping on the ice in the winter time and cracking it. And the wonderful patterns that cracked ice made on the pools of water. And I remember coming home. And our street was so vastly different then. It was a limestone road, and there was no concrete footpath, no gutters or anything like that. It was a bit of grass and water running through it and mud. And it was a great feeling to feel the mud squeezing between your toes. It was a wonderful feeling. Now, going to school, I was barefooted. And I cannot honestly remember when I was last in a pair of shoes. It'd have to be 60, 70 years ago. And I was born that way. And God willing, I want to be buried that way.
Lewis started work as a fisherman when he was 14, after his father died.
Not within 20 paces of where we are at the moment was the first fishing boat that I started to work on professionally. It was an elder fisherman and his 28-year-old son, and a very respected and, in my opinion, a little bit biased because he was the first, but in my opinion, the equal to any fisherman I'd ever fished with since. And we went fishing within 12 mile of King Island after sharks. Well, on the boat, when the skipper would tell me to do something, he would also show me how to do it. And I was expected perhaps to make a mistake once or twice, particularly with steering. Sometimes I'd be so serious of steering that I'd be looking up at the sky and I'd be looking at the particular stars, and I could be 20 or 25 minutes and not even deviate from the course. All of a sudden I might nod my head for a moment, and that'd be the time when the skipper would put his head up the wheel, out of the wheelhouse, and say, oh, gee, did I used to get scared, and I used to say to myself, oh, I hope one day I can be like those men. And I know now that I am, if not better, because I've worked all my life single-handed as a single-handed cooterman when I have not been working on a larger cray or shark boat. But experience is the best teacher. It needed to be the only teacher, because experience ignored can be very costly when your life's at stake. I started fishing at £5 a month. And included in the £5 a month when we were going away fishing, the skipper would, his wife would make Scotch broth. And believe me, it was Scotch broth, because all I could see in it at the time was coloured water. And I thought, whatever vegetables were supposed to be in it, they must have been sieved before they were dropped in, if any. And it was Scotch broth. And we used to have to bring that to a boil on an old Primus. And then we'd cup our hands around the cup at about 3:30 in the morning before we started setting our lines, which incidentally were about 8 miles from one end to the other. And we'd have 4,000 hooks, and we used to have to haul them all by hand. We didn't have the comforts of automatic winches or all this that the boats have got today, and they can literally get aboard their boat and just manipulate a couple of switches or levers, and your boat will go for 100 miles. It can go 10 hours, and where it wants to be in a position at a certain time in the morning, that's where it will be in that allotted time, because the skipper has put that information into the computer and the engine eases down. Well, when we got to what we consider as the fishing ground, the skipper of the boat used to get a big lead weight, about a pound weight, and he'd have a long attached line on it. If we're in about 200 feet of water, he'd have 200 feet plus of line attached to it, and he'd go to an old syrup tin or a jam jar that was filled with mutton fat, and he'd grease the base of the bottom of this lead with it. The boat would be stopped, and we had then an old 27 horsepower Chevrolet car engine, but often the engine was only used when there wasn't enough wind, so I was brought up 60% under sail with the help of a modern engine in those days, imagine it. And the boat would be stopped, and the skipper would drop the line, and as soon as it hit the bottom, he'd pull it up and he'd bring it up and he'd turn the lead around, and he could tell by indentations, marks in amongst the thick grease, whether it was on reef. And if there was no marks but it had a lot of sand on it, he'd know that's not the place he wanted to be. And if it come up with a piece of coal, it had fallen on a piece of coal or shell, that was what he was after. And until he was able to get the ground that he was looking for, we used to have to traverse in various courses, east and west, north and south, for an hour each way until we found it. But today, you throw a switch and the echo sounder tells you how deep you are. It shows you the reef on the bottom of the ocean, and it shows schools of fish. And today you can identify the fish, and everything has so vastly changed. And after 3 days, we would come home, and Mum never knew until that moment. As soon as I came to the back door early in the morning, she'd say, "Thank God, son, you're home." And I could go on and tell you at the time when the propeller fell off the boat with the skipper and his son, and we were 8 days at sea. They had light aircraft looking in Bass Strait for us. They had the lifeboat down the coast looking for us. But we got home with the sail up after adverse weather conditions changed, and we sailed home with a fair wind. And we had no radio those times. We were all right, but we couldn't convey that to our loved ones at home. They're the ones who were worried. But now they get out in the fishing grounds. "G'day, Mum. We're just starting fishing." And they're in communication all the time. They might be at sea a week or 10 days. But we were limited to a week because of our fuel supply.
This is Boxing Day Breakfast with Amanda Smith on the harbour at Queenscliff in Victoria with Lewis Ferrier, who spent his life fishing the waters out through the rip of Port Phillip Bay.
Now, I can even state that I was going fishing with my younger brother, and his boat was out of order, and the skipper of his boat wasn't able to take the boat. And Mum said, "Now look, son, your young brother Geoffrey is not working. It'd be a good idea if you took him out with you in the boat." So righto, he was young, married, and I took him. And we went out through this harbour entrance and got about 3/4 mile out through the entrance. And I said to brother at about 3:20 in the morning, you better take that rope off the deck and bring it inboard, I said, because we might hit a wave as we go over the bar at the entrance. And I said, if that rope trawls along the side of the boat and falls over and gets fouled of the propeller, we're in trouble. Well, in the dark, and not being familiar with my smaller boat against his bigger boat, he undid the wrong rope, and the boat went up the air to climb over a wave, and it fell out of his hands, the rope, and the mast came down, hit me on the head and broke my neck. And that was a terrible 5 years of being completely paralysed and undergoing torment and suffering. When I think of the young Superman at 52 years of age when he died, well, it was in 1952 that I had my accident.
After 5 years away from fishing, Lewis recovered from his injuries and got his own boat, a Cooter boat called Rosebud.
Well, the slipway, which is about 50 yards behind us, it was launched there on the 1st of December 1957, and we had about 200 people for the launching of the boat, and the parents and friends and family, they all had tables and afternoon tea and sandwiches and the like. It was a great day of a Saturday afternoon. I was one of the few non-drinkers, because previous to that, every fishing boat that was launched was heralded first by the consuming of two or three barrels, or 9 gallons, or an 18 was put on. And it wasn't for many years afterwards that they found that when the boat was about to be launched, the needed crowd of fishermen had depleted to such an extent that they never got a launched on the Saturday. It had to be till the Sunday. Well, then they put on the kegs after the launching, and that made a big difference. I had a launched, and I had the first air-cooled engine in the boat that was in the port, and my boat has had a remarkable charmed life. I've been in that boat when I have been in the middle of the rip after two or three days of severe southwest gales, when in between the trough of the swell that's gone past me, and they are literally at least 50 feet high. I've been unable to see the black lighthouse and the white lighthouse leads coming through the middle of the rip. I'm unable to see Point Nepean Headland or Point Lonsdale Lighthouse and the headland or anything behind me. And we're always told, never look behind. But we do. And when we see what's behind, we wish we hadn't, because it's an awesome sight. But again, I've got in. And in a fog, that when I have been caught in a fog, I slow down and I keep going. I have a little compass, and before it comes down, I bring the compass up in the deck and I line it up with a beacon of Lonsdale, and I'll go in there and I'll ease it down until I see the bottom. And then I can tell within a half a mile of the coastline of Point Nepean or Point Lonsdale as to how far off of the land I am, and I know which side of the heads I am, and then I see the movement on the surface of the water, and I can tell that it's the ebb tide running out, and I'll go on the edge of the tide, or I'll cut my motor and I'll let the flood tide take me in. And they stand in awe and say, how in the Haiti did you find your way home? I said, easy, but I've been sweating it out all the time. But I've always got home.
It hasn't been all fishing for Lewis, though, and his boat, Rosebud, has carried a few more glamorous passengers than fish. In 1959, the movie On the Beach was filmed in and around Melbourne. Part of the set for this Hollywood film about the end of the world was a submarine out in Port Phillip Bay.
And in the consequences of being moored here in this entrance to the cut here in Queenscliff, I used to go out to the South Channel, where there was an ex-English submarine with alterations to make it look nuclear by adding steel on top of the conning tower, something like about 25 feet high. And I was to convey certain members of the film group out to it, and in one of them was Gregory Peck, and he was adorned in his full regalia as Commander-in-Chief of the American Forces, not only the Navy, and he was resplendent in all his regalia, as I say. And then there was Fred Astaire. I forget what he was in the film, but I know...
He was a scientist. He played an English scientist, I think.
That's right, yes. Well, he was a renowned tap dancer. Now, on the deck of my boat, he tap danced. And I've got several photographs in several of the books and albums that I've got home, because my mum bred into us, never tell a lie, be sure your aim will find you out. And often a lot of people say, there goes Lou, yapping on again. And I'd say, just a minute. And I'd run up home a couple of houses, and I'd run down and say, well, looks are deceiving, aren't they? Who's that in that photograph? Oh, that's Gregory Peck aboard your fishing boat, for sure. And so I was able to show this thing. And I've had my boat used for the blessing of the fishing fleet, and I've used it extensively for conducting burials at sea with the scattering of the ashes of loved ones. And I've had several grooms aboard the boat during the weddings and conveying them out to the end of the pier where they get off onto the landing and have the wedding ceremony. So she's had a pretty, sort of a flowery life so far. And I think she's the greatest boat there is. But between my knowledge of what I think I know about the sea and my capabilities, of which I learned not only first of all from Mr. Johnson and his son, but my older brothers, who in turn I would fish with at various times. And I felt that if there was one thing that they had in common, it wasn't so much that you baited a line up this way or you did something that way, but you always had to remember, don't pitch your judgment against the elements. Go in before the elements are to the point where you're afraid of whether you're going to get home or not. So you just look, and forthcoming events cast their shadows beforehand. When you see the building up to the westward of the dark clouds, and when you see this long tube-like big horizontal cloud whirling and going around like that, you know there's wind there. And quite often it's preceded by rain, because the wind is behind the rain, and a deluge of rain comes. And rain's a good thing, because it's like a wet blanket. It shelters you from the wind that's coming behind you. But God willing, you're in port by then, and it can do what it's like. But I don't like thunder, and I don't like lightning.
Kuta boats, like Lou Ferrier's, are small wooden boats, 26 feet long, and named after the fish barracuda. Nowadays, these boats are collector's items, but they were designed to be working vessels for rough sea fishing.
In the early days, about 1870, when I believe the first Queenscliff fishermen were established in Queenscliff, the lower end of Beach Street here was occupied by a lot of Chinese men, and they had their little huts there. And they used to have shallow boats that they worked the inland waters of the bay and were able to go over shallow banks. But when about 1880 and 1885, 1890, when they became a little more adventurous and they headed out the heads, they found over a period of time that their boats were unsuitable. They soon got the knowledge that their boats weren't suitable for the roughness of the rip at various times. And so they approached a Norwegian boat builder, and he designed a particular boat, gave it a particular shape with a little bit of hollow in the bottom of the vessel, and then we put down a centreboard made of cast iron, and that gave us a deeper draft. So the old shallow boat evolved to, and there's the classic example. Look, it's as though today was made for you to come down there. See it on the slipway? Now, isn't that a beautiful shape? And I think there's about nearly 60 of them over at Portsea and Port Ferry. And those boats are retailing it up to $90,000 a boat. But they've been proven, and they are beautiful boats. They are lovely. Well, my lifetime has evolved around fishing boats, and The Kuta boat is a special boat, but so is the skipper of it. He is part and a component in the viability of that Kuta boat. You will only put your boat through what you feel she's capable of taking. You don't go full of bravado going into a big sea and going up and down, because you don't put your boat into a situation like that. And if you ever find yourself, you've got to know in which way to put the tiller, so instead of the boat going up the middle of a wave and falling down, because when it gets to a certain height than the wave, there's nothing underneath, and you'll bust the garboard or a plank in the bottom. So we push the tiller and manoeuvre the rudder until the boat slides off the side of the wave, and there's no damage done. She doesn't come down with a thud. She just slides down, and you say, "See, she wouldn't have cracked her egg. You beautiful thing, love. Come on, keep going." And we talk to the boat, and the boat seems to respond to whichever way you handle the tiller. And it becomes almost a living thing, so that I'm a component with my boat, and if I don't think my boat is capable or up to the situation, I'm not going to tempt Providence. I come home. Right from the beginning, right up until today, my life as a fisherman is exciting. I know not what the future holds, but I've got the faith that whatever comes, I'm going to be all right.
Ferrier, known as the Barefoot Fisherman, born on the beach at Queenscliff in Victoria in 1924, and 89 years later still with the sea air in his lungs and salt water in his blood. It's a minute to nine now here on RN. I'm Amanda Smith. It's been lovely to join you for breakfast today, and I'll be back with you later this morning actually for summer features. Today includes the story of the birth of ska music in Jamaica in the late 1950s, 1960s. Did you know, though, that there were Australian musicians involved? That's at 11 o'clock this morning here on RN. And tomorrow, Cathy Van Extel will be back with you for Summer Breakfast. ABC News is ahead now.